Okay, it's about time we got started. I know a few more people will be probably coming in because they're still commuting from other classes, but I've got quite a bit to talk about, so I'd like to get going here. One thing, by the way, which I don't think I said yesterday, or Friday at least, is that I have a years-long reputation of kind of fading out during lectures partly because the microphone doesn't fit very well in terms of where my mouth is. And if you find at some point in the lecture that you can't hear me, please put up your hand, because otherwise, you can't hear me already? Okay, well, I can start there by trying to get the volume a little higher. It's always a bit of a dance between the volume and feedback, which is going to start at some point. Okay, we'll try that. And yeah, do put up your hands if you can't hear me. Okay, so I wanted to just make one or two comments about the last bit I was talking about at the last lecture. And I kind of rushed, as usual at the end of a lecture, you're a bit rushed, and I kind of charged through this part. I showed a couple of potential rockets as being problematic when it comes to vibration. And vibration can be of a magnitude that can do real physical damage. The problem really is based on the fact that both of these rockets and the shuttle, for that matter, use solid rocket boosters, and the shuttle, because of that, is notorious as giving a very, very rough ride for the first 2 minutes on the way up. People are thrown around quite violently, and it's not quite at the level of danger, but it's not far from it. Now, these two rockets are, as I think I mentioned, are attempts at replacing the shuttle. The one on the left isn't going to happen because the program was canceled, and the one on the right probably won't be good for political reasons because it's partly European. Both of them, though, we're going to use a single solid rocket booster as a lower stage. And it's a very dangerous thing to do, especially since these are much, much lighter than the shuttle, and so there's not a lot of mass damping in there. Now, the one on the left, the Ares, has actually been launched once, and it gave reasonably good vibration readings. They'd be well within the level of human tolerance. The problem for anybody who's ever been around solid rocket motors is the knowledge that solid SRBs have individual personalities. No two behave exactly the same, and one could give you a very smooth ride, and another one could give you just a ride from hell. And so we really don't have proof that this either of these concepts would be appropriate. Okay, there's more to vibration though than just physically damaging somebody. You probably you might have experienced it in a car, for example, if you're on a very rough road, that there are times when you can't see very well, and it's very difficult to reach controls and things of that sort. Well, these things happen very quickly in a car, but in a launch, if the vibration is happening continuously, you can get into quite considerable trouble. This is an experiment that tried to show the performance degradation that can occur caused by vibration, and there were two tasks involved here. There's an upper one, the upper two graphs, a flat line, and the one above it, which this was a visual task. It was a task where you had to scan text and find errors. The lower pair, the next two curves down, not the bottom one, but the dashed ones in the middle, were a this was a placing task. This was trying to put markers on a board. So in one case, you've got, can you see? In the other, can you do anything with your hands? And what you see in both cases is that above a certain frequency, well, first of all, there's a serious degradation of performance. That's what's being measured here. It's performance as a function of frequency of vibration. There's clearly a degradation of both the ability to see and the ability to use your hand accurately. In the presence of vibration. The interesting thing is that decrement falls off with increasing frequency. And there's a very clear reason for that. This was all done at a constant acceleration, the same acceleration across all these different conditions. And as you go up in frequency, even though you have the same acceleration, amplitude and velocity go down. That's just the straightforward physics of the situation. So that as you get up to higher and higher frequencies, where it's really more of a buzz than a shaking, performance is not that bad. Nevertheless, down in the range where you would expect vibration in a launch, there's a very very large degradation of performance. And there's no easy solution around that. We're wired up the way we are. Our reflexes that we use for stabilizing our vision can only tolerate just so much, and we can't correct arm movements all that quickly. Really, the only answer to that one is to automate a launch. Now, something that pilot astronauts hate to hear, but in reality, there are many reasons why you really don't want to get a pilot involved when you're launching a spacecraft. They tend to make errors. Okay, I'm going to move on now. Okay, that's all I have to say about vibration. And I'm going to move on to a topic that is actually a lot more current than I anticipated when I was starting to prepare these lectures, and that is the effects of reduced atmospheric pressure. Now, think back to that model I used for describing where a low Earth orbit is. That's the styrofoam cup. Now, if you have the styrofoam cup, and the inside of the rim is the surface of the Earth, as I said before, the outside of the rim would represent orbital altitude. But if you want to show the thickness of the atmosphere in there, you probably have to have something thinner than a piece of saran wrap. Yeah, I mean, the atmosphere is very, very thin. And, of course, during a launch, any rocket that is doing the right thing is attempting to get above most of the atmosphere as soon as it possibly can to reduce drag and frictional heating and things like that. And remember from the balloon launch which killed two or three people back in the 1800s, you really don't have to go very far before you lose a lot of your atmosphere and of course, atmospheric pressure. In fact, you're down to about half of normal atmospheric pressure at around 18,000 feet. And that's just not very high up. There are many, many mountains that go considerably higher than that, for example. In fact, if you're in a non-pressurized aircraft, you have to use oxygen, supplemental oxygen, over 10,000 feet. It gets worse as you go up. At around 33,000 feet, the amount of oxygen that you can transport in your blood, the saturation of the blood with oxygen, starts to drop, even if you're breathing pure oxygen. And that is sort of the thing that is so topical, because just in the last few days, we had that incident on that Southwest Airlines aircraft that decided to open the sunroof. And what it demonstrated, I think, is a couple of things. One is, it was reported to have been at 37,000 feet. You have to be a little cautious here, because the only things I know about it are what I saw in the media, and they're not always accurate. But it seems it was at around 37,000 feet, which would be about where it ought to be. And it seems that some passengers lost consciousness. And also we know that the pilot, the fact that they survived, we know that the pilot dove down very, very quickly. And that is really an indication of why these drop-down oxygen masks, don't really work. They work to an extent. But if you're over 33,000 feet, and almost always you are in a transport aircraft these days, sometimes up in the low 40s, the amount of the oxygen saturation in your blood, even if you're breathing pure oxygen, which you would never get out of one of those masks anyway, is not enough. The only way in which you deal with a situation like that is you point it, well, you don't point it down and go, because you'll overspeed the aircraft. What you do is you cut back on thrust, you make it as draggy as possible, and you drop as fast as you can, which is very spectacular, but it's what you have to do if you're going to survive. They were down within 3 or 4 minutes, they were down to a quite breathable air, and of course everybody on board survived. There are actually low atmospheric pressure actually brings up two issues. One, of course, is the question of hypoxia, And I'll talk about the other in a few minutes. But hypoxia is a funny kind of thing. Hypoxia is just, by the way, it's just low oxygen, low blood oxygen. That is just an indication that you lose half your atmosphere by 38,000 feet, and we'll move on to where I really want to be, which is here. Now, this is could look a little bit surprising at first glance. What's charted there is how long you're going to stay conscious if you were suddenly transported from sea level to these various altitudes. And in this case, in the actual experiment, they were breathing oxygen, so that the saturation was equivalent to sea level. But the interesting thing is that you're not conscious very long. And if you were at the top of, if you were suddenly transported to an altitude equivalent to the top of Mount Everest, which is between 28 and 30,000 feet, you'd have maybe 3 minutes before you lost consciousness. Of course, people don't lose consciousness on Everest. Some are using supplemental oxygen, but there have been a number of climbers who have gone up without it, and they only survive simply because they were adapted to altitude. You can adapt to lower ambient pressure to an extent and do much better. But if you could transport from sea level to that altitude, you would not survive very long. By the way, those who have gone up without oxygen, there's almost 100% cerebellar damage, which can be detected. So it's not a very smart thing to do. The term here that they use is time of useful consciousness, and that brings up perhaps the most insidious part of what happens with hypoxia. When you're acutely exposed to very high altitudes, you will eventually lose consciousness, but you lose the ability to think before you do that. Now, I can give you a personal example of that from an altitude chamber ride that I had to take to qualify for test flying. But in that chamber ride, we went from essentially sea level to 35,000 feet explosively. They actually blow a diaphragm to go up very quickly. And at the same time, you would have a mask available, but you don't have it on. Now, this is not the kind of thing you want to do on your own. And, of course, there are people available to help you should you get in trouble. And the way they know you're in trouble is because they get you to draw little diagrams on a piece of paper. And it's little squares and triangles and stuff like that. You just go down a list. And once you stop doing it, well, you're in trouble. But you don't know you're in trouble. It's really quite amazing because you feel nothing. I mean, you don't feel like there's anything wrong at all, except all of a sudden you can't do this. And you're saying to yourself, this is really curious. I can't draw that. I could do that before, but I can't do it now. And you have no idea what's going on. Of course, what's going on is you're dying. And but you absolutely don't know. And you're not going to react appropriately. Obviously, they slap a mask back on you and you're fine very quickly. But it's an insidious kind of onset that is very, very dangerous. Years back, there was an aircraft took off from Cyprus, I believe it was, belonging to Helios Airlines, and it was another 737, and it had a decompression as it was approaching more or less the same altitude as the Southwest aircraft was. The failure was not explosive. It was caused by a maintenance screw up and the fact that the pilots didn't react properly. But basically, everybody on the plane lost consciousness, including the crew. The aircraft went on flying for another couple of hours and then eventually crashed, and everyone was killed. You can imagine, though, that the crew at some point heard alarms, because we know the alarms went off. That was on the flight data recorder, or rather the voice recorder. And, you know, there are audible warnings that, you know, the pressure is gone. You're in real trouble. And the pilots are just discussing how curious it is that this alarm's going off, and without a thought that you had to do something. So all this to say that hypoxia will do you in, and it's a very, very insidious kind of thing. By the way, you don't have to be at 30 or more thousand feet to feel hypoxia. Typically, above 10,000 feet, you should use pressurized. You're supposed to use oxygen because you start making. You just gradually get less, more and more stupid as time goes on. And if you happen to be a smoker or if you've had a drink, it's much worse. You can get in that trouble at 7,000 or 8,000 feet, which isn't very high up. Yeah.
Is there a difference about the time until you pass out between these various altitudes, or is this just the amount of the useful consciousness?
That's a very good question. This is useful consciousness. This is still able to do rational things. I would think once you've reached the end of useful consciousness is probably a pretty fixed time until you lose consciousness. But it takes longer to get to that point. Because once you've lost useful consciousness, your blood oxygen is down to a pretty fixed level. And so the rest is just going to go. Yeah. Not to any meaningful extent. I mean, somebody who lives at a very high altitude will have a higher amount of hemoglobin in their blood, and they would do better. Not really. And the difference between 120 seconds and 130 seconds, it really doesn't matter in this context. Okay, let me move on to the second issue then that I mentioned, caused by low ambient pressure, and that's something called the bends, or decompression sickness. Now, when I say the bends, I would expect that most of you think of in terms of divers who have been very deep in the water for a while and have come up too quickly, and indeed that's certainly one major cause of the bends. The bends are clinically, what you're going to see is somebody with things like joint pains or cough, a dry cough that they can't really stop. And sometimes, if they're in real trouble, neurological signs, including unconsciousness or seizures, all kinds of nasty things. The point that I want to make, though, is that it really doesn't matter at all if you develop the bends because you went from several atmospheres to one atmosphere, as in the diver, or from one atmosphere to something less than that, as in the pilot flying at high altitude. It's basically just a simple summation of the two effects, which, by the way, is why you should never, ever, if you're on a holiday, go scuba diving in the morning and then go flying home in the afternoon, because you can actually develop bends. There are more provocative situations. For example, in Hawaii, it is not at all uncommon for people to both to go scuba diving and to go up to the top of Mauna Kea, which is the site of some big astronomical telescopes, including the Keck telescopes. And that's a very quick drive. That's just an hour and a half from sea level to about 14,000 feet. Now, one thing that if you try to go with a commercial operation, people that tour you up there, they will not let you in their bus if you have gone diving for the last 24 hours, which is entirely wise. But then what often happens is people say, well, I'm going anyway, so they get in their car and they drive up. And there is a fair incidence of serious bends on top of Mauna Kea. The two sum. It's just a reduction in pressure. So what are the bends? You probably mostly know what the bends are. It's a mechanism that's been known for many, many, many years. In fact, it was actually demonstrated by Robert Boyle, of Boyle's Law fame, back in the 1600s, he was doing an experiment where he had a snake, inside a bell jar and pumped out the air. When he did that, he noted that there was a bubble that formed in the eye of the snake. And I guess this illustrates a couple of things. One is that Boyle didn't like snakes a lot. And also that gases that are dissolved within the blood, primarily nitrogen, are going to turn into bubbles. If you don't give that gas enough time to get out of the blood and escape from the body. So you've got to get rid of all the nitrogen that's dissolved within your body, and sudden exposure to high altitude is a very good way of not giving you enough time and of causing bends. Now, this is an experiment that was done where basically people were just simply either just sitting, or they were exercising, moderate exercise on a bicycle, if I remember correctly. And what they're measuring here is the incidence of the bends, really. It's incidence of forced descents. It means somebody developed symptoms and they had to break off the experiment. And what you see there is they started at various altitudes and obviously breathing oxygen to compensate. And the question was, you know, how often are people going to get the bends? Well, below 25,000 feet or so, it's almost never going to happen. Above that, though, there's an increasing incidence of symptoms. And interestingly enough, and it's somewhat counterintuitive, those who exercised had a much worse record than those who were just simply sitting there quietly. And you would kind of expect that exercise would get the heart beating faster, your circulation going, and you'd get rid of gas faster than if you were just sitting there. That happens to be true, by the way. But the problem is if you're doing the exercise at altitude, what happens is that the exercise initiates bubble formation. For example, in the joints. If you sometimes some people can snap their joints, when they move their hand. I don't have a joint to demonstrate, but you've all heard this. You know, somebody squats down, you hear a snap. What you're hearing is a bubble forming in the joint. It's not an air bubble as such. It's it's actually water vapor. You're getting a cavitation in that joint, and that. When the pressure goes down a little bit, that bubble collapses and you get a water hammer effect. So that's what the little snap is. That in itself can initiate the formation of a gas bubble, and that's the basic reason why you get a higher incidence of the bends in people who are exercising at altitude. In space flight, the bends are a problem during EVAs. They're a problem when you go into spacesuits. Shouldn't be a problem inside most spacecraft because typically they're running at sea level pressure. So it's not that's not the problem. It's when you get into a spacesuit and have to go outside. And there's a very good reason for that. Spacesuits are very, very tricky machines. And one of the biggest problems that one has with a spacesuit is flexibility, because once you inflate it, you turn into a Michelin man. And that's particularly bad for the fingers. You've got to be able to bend your fingers and use your hand. And if you inflate the spacesuit up to full normal sea level pressure and go into a hard vacuum, you won't be able to bend your fingers at all. So what they have to do is run spacesuits at just over 4 pounds per square inch, which is equivalent to about 30,000 feet. In other words, just below that point where you have to start. You have to start pressure breathing, actually. It's just below that point where even 100% oxygen isn't going to be good enough. You do run a spacesuit at 100% oxygen, by the way. So they're really marginal things. And so you've got to run them at low pressure. And what happens, of course, is this is a setup for the bends, because you've got to get to these low pressures. And If you have to do it, which you do, how do you approach this? You don't just put somebody in a spacesuit, drop the pressure, and send them outside. What you do is a staged sequence of gradually lowering the pressure while the person's breathing pure oxygen, so that they have an opportunity to get rid of the nitrogen in their blood and the rest of their body, and they exercise. which you would remember, it's not the same as this. It's not exercising once they're outside. It's exercising under higher pressure to allow the quicker loss of nitrogen from the body, but not in a situation where you're actually going to trigger the bends. It's still very, very marginal. And if you do the sort of protocols they do, the pre-breathing protocols on the ground, and look for bubble formation with Doppler techniques, you find that even using the techniques that are the protocols that are in use today, when somebody goes out in a spacesuit, you get about 50% incidence of bubbles. You can actually see bubbles or detect them with Doppler techniques with this protocol. There have been a couple of cases of the bends as well. Bubbles can be fairly innocuous in some cases. It all depends where they end up. So it's a very real. This is a very real issue, and it's a very big limitation in terms of what you can do in spacesuits. Okay. Finally, I guess just to mention it, if those of you who have a particularly morbid curiosity, what happens if the pressure really drops on a person? What if you get into a hard vacuum? You know, this is the stuff of science fiction writing where your eyes pop out or you boil or you explode, whatever. The reality is you don't. You certainly aren't going to live very long because of hypoxia, you will develop the bends. But your skin is sufficiently elastic that you maintain enough internal pressure that you don't get above the vapor pressure of water, and therefore you don't boil, and therefore you don't explode, which is a good thing. Now, theoretically, of course, if you got into a hard vacuum, but you restored pressure very quickly, you might survive. You might think you'd survive. And in fact, this has actually happened. There was an accident at Johnson Space Center in the Apollo era, where a spacesuit was being tested with an engineer in it in a hard vacuum chamber, and for reasons that I won't go into, the suit got suddenly depressurized. It got depressurized to a hard vacuum, and obviously, with a lot of people watching, they reversed the situation as fast as they could. It was a very big chamber, so it took at least 30 seconds to come up to a reasonable pressure. And they really thought they'd killed this individual. He was actually starting to get up before they got inside, and demonstrated that it is possible to be exposed to a hard vacuum for a very short period of time and apparently not suffer any serious long-lasting consequences. Certainly not the kind of thing you would want to do. So what do you do? Basically, we can't live unless we have a suitable atmosphere, and that's one of the big challenges of spaceflight. You have to provide some kind of pressure vessel. You have to provide a means of providing oxygen, getting rid of CO2, providing atmospheric pressure, and that pressure vessel can be all kinds of different things. It's just a container. The simplest one of all, which has never been used, by the way, is on the top left, which is that thing that looks like a great big beach ball, which was a mechanism that was actually developed in the days when people thought multiple shuttles would be flying at the same time. And if one got in trouble, they would move the crew from one to the other. Of course, they didn't have enough spacesuits, so they developed this escape device, which was really just a big beach ball. And individual crew members would get inside there, they'd zip it up, seal it, obviously, and then hand carry it, essentially, from one shuttle to the other to save the crew member. Pretty heroic, and I don't think I'd ever want to be dependent on somebody who, you might know is not very good at soccer or something, because you really would be dependent on the other person doing it right. They, of course, would be in a spacesuit, like in the top right. That's a totally contained, much more sophisticated device, which in some cases allows a bit of mobility, as well as all the thermal and atmospheric controls that you need in a spacesuit. It's still a small device, but it's still just a pressure vessel. Shuttle or any other vehicle that you go up in is, again, just a way of providing a pressurized, breathable atmosphere. And ultimately, you've got things like space station, which do the same thing. At the same time, of course, as you prevent hypoxia, you're also, because typically these things are maintained other than the spacesuit, because they're maintained at one atmosphere of pressure, you don't have to worry too much about the bends. The spacesuit, as I say, you have to pre-breathe, you have to get rid of most of the nitrogen before you get out there. All of these things work very well. The spacesuit is kind of marginal, but it does work. So everything, I guess what I've said so far then, last lecture and this one, just indicates that getting into space is a real physiological challenge. And now I want to talk a little bit, shift gears a bit, and talk about what happens when you get there. Everything I've talked about so far is not new. It's all been experienced before in the world of aviation. And, you know, for the most part, we have solutions, or at least we know what our limits are. Some of it's from diving, of course, for the bands. But basically, this is not a terribly novel environment. You do know your limits. There's one thing, one issue in spaceflight that, one aspect of that environment that's never been, that was never experienced by anyone before 50 years ago this year, and that is prolonged weightlessness. And you simply, you could never be exposed to prolonged weightlessness before you had spaceflight. Now, weightlessness is sometimes called microgravity, it's sometimes called zero Gs. These are all different names for the same thing. Some of them are better than others. They don't all mean exactly the same thing, but they basically mean being in space. And it's certainly the most unique feature of spaceflight. Now, just a few words about what weightlessness is. I'm not going to go into this in great detail, but I just want to make sure that nobody thinks that that weightlessness is a lack of gravity. That's where this zero-G, zero-gravity thing is a bad name, because it's not zero-gravity. I mean, if there was no gravity in space, our moon would have left us a long time ago, and anything else that's in orbit would actually go in a straight line and disappear. I mean, there is gravity. At low Earth orbit, it's about 85% of normal gravity, in fact. Weightlessness simply occurs whenever you remove whatever it is that's preventing you from being accelerated towards the surface of the Earth, or the core of the Earth, by gravity. Now, that this thing that's keeping you from accelerating could be the seat you're sitting in, the floor, the building. It could be the wing of an aircraft. It can be the buoyancy forces if you're in water. You're not weightless in water. You're simply neutrally buoyant, and that's not the same thing at all. If you think about it, every one of us has been weightless at some point. In fact, at many, many points. Every time we run and get off the ground or jump down off of something, we are very transiently weightless. We're in a state of free fall, and that's all that weightlessness is. In most normal situations, weightlessness doesn't last very long. If you go off a high diving board, you're talking a second or a little more, but that's, that you are, as long as you're not going so fast that you're starting to get into a drag situation, you are, in fact, weightlessness. So weightlessness, then, is simply being in a state of free fall, and the duration of weightlessness depends only on one thing, and that's how far you can fall. And, but obviously that puts on some pretty severe limits. The farthest you can fall without going into space is flying in an aircraft doing what's called parabolic flight. And I just want to make a couple of points about this. It's not, sometimes it's described as, you take an object and you drop it. Yeah, that object is in weightlessness, but you can double the duration of weightlessness by falling up as well as down. So, in fact, that would be the entry situation for going into a zero-G parabola. At that point, that aircraft has actually been pulling Gs. It pulls up to a certain angle, and then what it does is it takes the entire contents of the aircraft and throws them up into the air. It's also got a forward velocity, as aircraft have to have. And what it does, once it's tossed everything up into the air, is it flies around them. And that's it. It's theoretically very simple. In practice, it's a really tricky bit of flying. That aircraft there, which is probably still the best one, it's not flying anymore, unfortunately, but it was probably the best one for doing parabolas, goes about, in each parabola, goes about 8,000 feet up, 8,000 feet down, and about 4 to 5 miles forward. And it's if they fly it within a couple of feet of the theoretically perfect trajectory to do that. In that you get, and basically, by the way, how they, yeah.
What is the purpose of flying a parabola?
Because that's the, that is the profile that, and if you take an object and you shoot it up into the air at about 45 degrees, which is what this is, it will follow a parabolic trajectory in free fall.
Right.
So you, you have to, if anything other than that, you're supporting the object you've thrown into the air.
But I mean, why do that?
Why do it? Well,
why
you would do it is to generate about 24 seconds of weightlessness each time you do this.
So is it just for training mostly?
It's for all kinds of things. It's for training. It's for testing equipment to make sure it's going to function in zero G. It's for doing experiments, but only experiments that do not require prolonged zero G. Anything you can, any effect you can measure within 24 seconds, you can study in that aircraft.
Yeah.
And it's a lot cheaper way than going in space.
Yeah.
Okay, and in fact, it's only at this point where you start actually being able to do things, like experiments or equipment tests. It's still very limited. You can only look at very, very acute effects. And ultimately, of course, if you want to really study what the effects of weightlessness, you have to go to orbit. Now, orbit is really nothing more than a trajectory in which when you fall, you keep on going around the Earth. Because if you look at this, there are various kinds of trajectories that you might achieve if you started, if you went into free fall at the top of that line that's called 1. Now, that indicates simply dropping without any kind of forward velocity. You will be weightless until you hit the ground. If you have a horizontal velocity as well, you can follow, say, trajectory 2 or 3 or 4, all of which will take you farther and farther and farther around the Earth. That would be, 4 would be what happens when you drop the external tank of the shuttle on a launch. They drop it when they're not quite into an orbital trajectory. The perigee is in the atmosphere, and it drags and comes down. 5 is where you finally achieve, well, in this case, what looks like a circular orbit. But basically, you are in free fall, but continuously going around the Earth. 6 is an escape trajectory, which means you went a little too fast, and you're going to go into, well, you probably end up in a very highly elliptical orbit. By the way, just as an aside, if you think about it, the term parabolic flight is totally wrong because it assumes a flat Earth, and I think we've disproved that a while ago. In fact, it should be called ellipsoid flight because you're following an ellipse. You're following a partial orbit, and that's just a small aside. Okay, so you get weightless by getting into orbit and by being in a constant state of free fall. And when you get into weightlessness, prolonged weightlessness, it's fun. It's pleasant. It's everybody likes it. And, once you stop throwing up anyway. And it really is you can do things in weightlessness that you can't do on the ground. I mean, all of a sudden your world becomes three-dimensional. You don't have to go around somebody. You can go over somebody. You can do all kinds of things that you can't do on the ground. So why is weightlessness? I mean, if weightlessness, as I say, is a unique feature of spaceflight, and it also is one of the things that brings that raises the most problems when it comes to human beings in space. And why is that? And by the way, it's not just going into weightlessness. Any change of our ambient G level is likely to cause all the problems, or at least some variation on the problems that I'm going to talk about. Remember what I was saying at the very beginning of the first lecture, and that had to do with evolution. You know, we have evolved in a very stable environment, and within that, those various environmental factors, there's no question that gravity is the most stable of all our environmental features. We have adapted, every one of our body systems has, where necessary at least, has adapted to being in a 1G environment, and there's no question. I mean, one would assume if you went into a different G level that many body systems are going to have problems. You're going to be deconditioned. And that's exactly what happens. And so I'm just going to mention some of the issues. These are some of the medical issues that we have to face, which are caused by weightlessness. And there's probably enough material there for about two courses, but hopefully we can get through them in some reasonable order. Okay, from the top, lots of things happen to the nervous system, and which you kind of expect because, amongst other things, the nervous system senses gravity at the level of the inner ear, so you expect problems. Motion sickness is always an issue in space flight. Acutely, you adapt. Just like getting onto a ship, you adapt after a few days and you're okay. But for those first few days, you're not in too good shape. It's caused by the fact that essentially, every time you move your head, the signals you get back from your vestibular system, from your inner ear, are not the ones your brain predicts. And whenever there's a conflict between what the brain predicts in the way of sensory inputs and what it actually gets, you get motion sick. And that's the bottom line there. It's about depends on who, how carefully you ask crew members, but it's probably about 65% incidence of motion sickness. So it's an extremely provocative environment. Spatial disorientation, not knowing which way is up. Early in a flight, if somebody has just, if you've just gone into space and there's no strong visual down, a cockpit or something that you're used to, that where there is a visual down, it's very difficult to tell which way is up. You get very confused very quickly. Later on, you develop the ability to define what up is. You can flip the world so that you can think, I am upright. No, I'm upside down. And you can just psychologically flip it. And you feel like you're psychologically, perceptually, you think you're upside down. But there's no question that you are typically quite spatially disoriented when you first go into space. Of course, that's not so bad. What is bad is if you get spatially disoriented during reentry, where you've gone from zero G to some positive G level. And then, if you're flying the shuttle, for example, and you get spatially disoriented, that's not a good thing. That could lead to an accident. Gaze instability, we have this wonderful system that comes from the vestibular system to the extraocular muscles, which stabilize the eye despite rather violent head movements. And the vestibular signals are not correct until they adapt once you're in space and after you're coming back to the ground. And again, you have difficulty maintaining your gaze on a target when you're coming back. Now, you add that to the vibration effect that I was talking about earlier, because re-entry tends to, at least in like a Soyuz, is quite rough. And it becomes very, very difficult to see things, to see checklists, to see where that switch is that you have to use. Postural instability. People tend to fall over once they land. They are not, their reflexes, the normal reflexes that allow you to stand upright, because, we're basically unstable, we're like an upside-down pendulum, and we have to use our vestibular reference all the time to keep from falling over. Well, if that's not there, or we're still, if it's not there, but vision is, then you have a problem. Why is that a problem? Because, if you're in the shuttle, for example, the whole area you're in is tipped, and you get up out of your seat, you orient to the visual world, which is tipped, and it's like being in a tilted room. You can lose control very, very quickly. That's postural instability, proprioceptive errors. Proprioception is the ability to know where your limb is and how it's moving. And there's no question that when you first go into a changed gravity environment, and that's going to zero or going from zero to something else, when you reach for something, you're not very successful. If, for example, I was trying to touch that telephone and I had just gone into zero G, I would do that, and I would have missed it, because it's a ballistic kind of movement, and I'm not compensating for the fact that my arm doesn't weigh anything anymore, and I can't, my proprioceptive system, which tells me where my limb is, hasn't yet compensated for this, hasn't adapted. It does very, very quickly, within a few minutes, actually, but initially it's not very good. that is also, I mean, again, when you're in space, it's not a big deal because you have the time to do things slowly and so forth. And by the way, if you in space, if you close your eyes, you lose track of where your limbs are. You can relax fully. There's no more signals coming in from there. And, you know, your limb can drift around. And when you open your eyes, it's usually not where you expect it to be. Again, that's a curiosity. That doesn't really matter. If you're coming back, trying to fly a vehicle, and your limb is not doing what you expect it to do, it's not the proprioceptive feedback is abnormal, you're in a setup for over-controlling, basically making control errors. Yeah? It depends entirely on the system. A proprioceptive function adapts very, very quickly. Gaze stability adapts much more slowly, and there are other things that are in between. Motor control errors, that's a part of the inability to reach, but it also is when you try to walk and you can't. For example, your motor neurons are not as, if you've been in space for a while, your motor neurons are not as excitable as they once were, and you try to walk and you stumble around and feel very heavy and so on. The last one in that category, increased intracranial pressure, is a new one. This is something that we've only learned about in the last 5 or 6 years, and it only started becoming evident when people started spending prolonged periods in the International Space Station, and there was an equipment on board to do appropriate medical testing. This is a big deal. This is something that may very well be a showstopper for prolonged spaceflight, at least without an artificial gravity environment. What's happening is that with time, the pressure within the ventricles of the brain, the intracranial pressure, slowly rises. It probably related to the fact that fluid tends to shift towards the head when you're in zero-G. Normally, it tends to go more towards the feet, but in space, it goes towards the head. And people develop increased intracranial pressure, which by itself may or may not do anything. But what it does do is cause visual problems. There is a connection between the brain and the eyeball, which is the optic nerve, and the pressure that you see within the brain is reflected in the optic nerve. And the optic nerve is basically, if you think of the eyeball, it's just a ball with a nerve coming in the back like that, just a stalk. When this swells, it pushes on the back of the eye, and it does things like changing the focal length of the focal distance of the eye, so that people become far-sighted because they're still focusing, but the retina is not where it was supposed to be, and so they develop poorer vision, hypermetropia. They also develop swelling of the optic nerve, which by itself is not so bad, except that it can shut off the blood supply to part of the retina, and then that part of the retina dies, and you can end up with patchy blindness, and that actually has happened, and they're still trying to figure out what you do about it and what how widespread a problem it is. It is, however, a very big deal, and it's one of the three reasons why we think you shouldn't be going off into deep space anytime soon until this is understood. Okay, musculoskeletal system. If you were in bed for a prolonged period, prolonged bed rest, you'd lose muscle, there's muscle wasting. Well, it's exactly the same thing in space. The anti-gravity muscles get weaker and smaller. Not too surprising. This is reversible. The only thing you have to watch out for is you don't want to get into severe exercise with muscles that are in that condition. You will damage them. And it's the same as getting out of bed if you've been sick and you've been in bed for a long time. Back pain is the most common symptom in space flight. It's because you actually get longer when you're in space.
What gets longer?
You do. Oh. You get taller. Your spinal cord, your spinal column actually elongates as the intervertebral discs expand because they're no longer loaded. The problem is that that's not, I mean, we get longer every night. You know, anyone who's short knows that if they want to feel better about themselves, they get measured in the morning because they're taller. But it happens to an extreme in space. It can be 2 inches longer. That's rare, but it's more like an inch usually. But an inch is a lot, and it can pull on nerve roots and cause chronic back pain, and the most prescribed medication in spaceflight is various analgesics. Bone demineralization, you lose bone just like an elderly individual would. And it's not because bone is laid down. Bone is a dynamic tissue. It's constantly being absorbed and laid down again. And the absorption part doesn't change, but the laying down of bone does. It becomes much less, probably because of the lack of stress on the bone. And so bone demineralization is a serious issue, although probably mostly reversible. And it's just a question of being careful when you get back. A cardiovascular system, the heart gets smaller and weaker to the point where if you don't exercise in space, you can get into congestive heart failure when you come back to the ground. Has happened. The baroreceptor reflex goes away. That's a control system problem. That's the system that keeps us from fainting when we suddenly stand up from bed. And it acts by sensing blood pressure and feeding that back to control the rate and strength of contraction of the heart and the contraction of blood vessels. That causes fainting. I mean, if you don't have a baroreceptor reflex and you stand up after spaceflight, you will faint. There was a notorious case within the last couple of years where a female astronaut fainted twice during a news conference, and it looked like, oh, this is a special thing. But it's been going on all along. John Young, after the landing of the first shuttle flight, fainted. So it's not just, anybody can. Immunosuppression is something that we don't know a whole lot about, except it's probably cell-mediated. And the main thing is it seems to happen. We don't know why. But it might decrease resistance to both infection and tumors. Infections haven't been a problem. Well, actually, neither infections nor tumors have been a problem. And I'll say a little bit more about potential dangers of that in the next lecture. So anyway, the bottom line is that weightlessness causes all these problems and probably quite a few others that we don't know about. And why don't you do something about it? Why don't you just build a rotating space station and be done with all of it? Well, the trouble is we just don't have the technology to do that right now. Actually, from a physiologist's point of view, the best thing to do would be to go to Mars by accelerating at 1G, or gradually transition to Martian gravity, but accelerating the entire way, but accelerate towards it for half the flight and accelerate in the opposite direction for the second half, so you're actually slowing down. And that would be the best thing, because it would you'd get rid of almost all of those problems. Of course, we can't even come close to doing that. We don't have engines that can do it. Space stations, rotating space stations, are not really the solution, because they're big. They introduce all kinds of technical problems, such as mass, because you've got to build in the strength to withstand the forces that you're generating by it rotating in the first place. And if you make it small, then you end up with a thing that has to go around so fast that every time you move your head, you get something called Coriolis stimulation, and you get disoriented, and you can't adapt, and you get sick again. Maybe 2 spacecraft at opposite ends of a tether, that might work if you can deal with stability and maneuvering problems. It's still stretching technology a little bit. I think ultimately, though, you have to ask yourself is the extra mass to oppose the forces caused by the rotation, is it worth it? Is there any point in building artificial gravity? I mean, yes, we have a whole bunch of problems, but they're medical problems. And to me, artificial gravity in space is kind of like creating a lawn in the desert. It's driven more by nostalgia than necessity. And, if you have medical problems, I think we could probably come up with medical solutions. Certainly, a lot of these there are medical solutions for. Others, well, we're not so sure, but it'll happen with time. We don't know all of them at the present time, though. Okay, that's all for today, and we'll be back at it on Wednesday in a different location. In a different location. The next, it's 1 something, but I'm not sure what it is. It's 156.